Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Baldron. With me, my co-host from Old Homosassa, Barry Rose. Barry, where the hell is Old Homosassa anyway?
That's awesome. Rip the Crippler Oliver from Old Homosassa. I think it's a suburb of Tampa somewhere, kind of far out, but I'm not really sure. And coincidentally, so I asked Dave Sierra, Fidel Sierra, the Cuban assassin, who was pretty friendly with Rip Oliver, is he in Old Homosassa? Apparently he is back there. So that's a guy I would love to get in touch with and invite him to one of our fan fests as well.
A special shout out to Rip the Crippler Oliver. Here on Breaking Kayfabe, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We'll break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. We are going to break kayfabe, woo, on life. And on today's show, we are going to be discussing two matches. Once again, we're not going to go back to my top 100. Maybe you're getting a little bored of that. So we're going to examine another match from 1985 that received actual votes in the Wrestling Observer Match of the Year category. And when I hit you with this one, you're going to go, what the fuck? Anyway, and the other match we're going to discuss, and by God, now that I'm bringing it up, I can't remember who it was that posted it on our Breaking Kayfabe with Baldron and Barry Facebook page. Somebody posted a link to a match from 1966, Barry, from All Japan Wrestling. We're talking Giant Baba versus the evil Nazi Fritz Von Erich. And we're going to discuss that match. We're also going to talk a little bit about Chris Benoit and some things that have recently been posted on our Facebook page. And then finally, top five, ready, Barry, Hollywood scandals.
Oh, man, juicy stuff.
We're
right
doing
here.
We're doing sex. We're doing murder, scandal.
That's what I wanted to know. All right.
Yeah, good stuff. So, all right, you're about ready
are
to go, man.
Are sex and drugs involved? Sex is involved, drugs?
There may be. That's all I'm going to say. Okay. There may have been allegations.
Right. Allegedly.
There may have been allegations of autoerotic asphyxiation. That's easy for you to say.
Oh, this is one of my favorites then. Yes. I say we just cut right to the chase, Jeff.
I'll try to say right asphyxiation again, Barry. Anyway, so before we start, Barry, I'm going to ask you something else that was posted recently on not necessarily our board, but I saw it on Facebook. Barry, here's your choice. You have to go through the rest of the natural life of Barry Rose, and you have to eliminate one of these particular food groups. Barry, I'm talking burgers, tacos, chicken wings, or pizza. What are you doing away with? You can't have it anymore, Barry.
So I saw this, and I purposely stayed away. And here was the funny thing. When I first looked at the meme that was put up there, and I forget who actually posted this meme, but I changed my mind like an hour later. So I can tell you, pizza is number one for me. I am not getting rid of pizza ever. It is probably my favorite food. I love pizza. I can eat it every day. Pizza is always going to be there for me. Burgers, probably my number two, because I'm eating burgers probably the other three or four days of the week. It really came down to tacos or chicken wings I'm going to get rid of. And this is tough, because if I make one item at home that's as perfect can be, it's chicken wings. It's the easiest thing to make. At the same time, that's the one I'm going to do away with. I'm going to go with tacos. And I think partly the reason is that if I got to get rid of chicken wings, you know, I can still do boneless chicken. I can still put the hot sauce on that. I can do a whole chicken if I want to. I could do fried chicken. So I could still keep chicken in my life. But if you said pizza, tacos, or burgers, not in your life, I don't know if I could do that. So adios, chicken wings. I love you, but adios.
Okay, I'm going to keep the pizza, the burgers, and the chicken wings and say adios, tacos. I'm a tacos fan, don't get me wrong. But if I got to do away with one of those four, I'm saying adios to the tacos. Barry, before we get to our next topic, food related, also, you recently posted that you had a chance to visit White Castle. Give us the White Castle report.
Yeah, absolutely, too. So with White Castle, I don't think there's a single person that steps in and that doesn't understand how gross and disgusting it is. At the same time, there is a certain crave factor that you have for the food. And look, I know what it is. I know it's pure crap. On the scale of all the fast food that's out there, White Castle's got to be really close down to the bottom. That being said, I like to go in, I don't know, 3 or 4 times a year. It's about an hour for me. If I'm ever in the area, I stop in. So I stopped in yesterday, and I got just a little bit of a backstory. I've been trying to eat healthier. I am in my 50s. I eat a shit ton of candy. I like to eat fast food. So over the last couple of months, I have tried to cut out carbs a little bit. I have fruit and vegetables on a daily basis, so I'm trying to be a little bit better. But that being said, I walked into White Castle. I ordered the number one combo meal, which is 4 White Castles with cheese, fries, and a beverage. And then I got the vegetable-based slider, which is called the Impossible Burger. So I took a bite of the Impossible Burger, and I was like, you know, that really tastes what I would imagine if I was just to sit here and just start eating goat shit. This is exactly what I would imagine that a burger would taste like, this burger. So it was terrible. So I took a second bite, didn't get any better. I think I took a third bite. I had to make sure, Jeff. I didn't want to take a couple bites. So I ate the entire thing, but it was disgusting. I then ate the rest of the White Castle burgers. They were disgusting, and I literally felt it queasy for like the next 3 or 4 hours. And certainly when I posted in our Facebook group, which is really, it's the most active Facebook group I think I've ever seen, which really just says that we don't have any lives. I don't know what it says, but it, to some degree, everybody is just, it's like a family almost. But to that end, I posted, people said, you're going to be running for the bathroom. I did not make a run for the bathroom. I got to admit though, I felt like green all night. So that was probably my last visit to White Castle, I'm going to assume. But Jeff, I have a question for you. You know what time it is, Jeff? Can you look at your watch? Can you see it? We're recording again. It's like 12:30 in the morning. But Jeff, I have an F. Mary kill for you. Do you think you can handle this one? This is an epic F. Mary kill, and I stayed up all night trying to come up with 3 names. And it's only 3. I think the last couple weeks we were tossing out 4, but it's only 3. Are you ready? Are you buckled in for this F. Mary kill?
I'm ready, but I will say before we start that, Green Bomb, think about this for a t-shirt. White Castle tastes like goat shit. Go!
At some point, we do have to get all these t-shirts because we have some great ideas. So I'm going back to 80s music, and I'm taking the lead singers, and they're all female, Jeff.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, exactly. I felt that was only fair. I'm taking the lead singers of 3 very popular female-led bands from the 1980s. You've got Belinda Carlisle from the Go-Go's, Susanna Hoffs coming from the Bengals, and Deborah Harry coming from Blondie. Jeff, out of those 3 names that I've just tossed to you, who is your F. Mary kill?
Easy peasy, fresh and breezy. I am killing Deborah Harry. I am effing the living hell out of Susanna Hoffs, who, by the way, based on what I've seen recently, still looks pretty good. Yeah. And I'm marrying my girl, Belinda Carlisle. My girl, Belinda, who, by the way, was my hall pass for years. My wife and I have had an agreement. If, God forbid, I should ever one day run into Belinda Carlisle in a Bull Nakano-like situation, my wife said, go ahead. Unfortunately, that's never happened, and now Belinda has been the victim of some bad plastic surgery based on some recent photos I've seen, so I am revoking that particular hall pass and in search of a new hall pass. So I'm going to marry Belinda, F. Susanna Hoffs, and kill Deborah Harry. Those are my choices.
Those are good choices, too. So you're 100% correct when it comes to Belinda Carlisle's plastic surgery. And there, I assume there's some sort of mental illness with people where they go, they get plastic surgery, they look horribly disfigured, but in their mind, everything's great. I can't quite figure it out. She was super hot and sexy. Do you remember, and I'm sure you and I have talked about this, the cover of Rolling Stone magazine from 1984 that had the Go-Go's on the front cover, and they were all in their underwear and t-shirts?
Why would I remember something along those lines? I'm shocked that you would even speculate about that.
I lived on that magazine cover. I loved it.
I do remember the Belinda Carlisle Playboy issue from a few years after that. So, yes, Belinda was quite hot back in the day, especially after she lost the chubby Belinda and went to the straight up hot and sexy Belinda. So,
yeah,
anyway.
Absolutely. And you're right about Susanna Hoffs also. Susanna Hoffs is still looking gorgeous, and dare I say, possibly looks better now than she did some 30 years ago when the Bengals were on top of the charts.
Wait a minute, sir. That is quite the statement to make. All right.
Yeah.
Time for us now, Barry, to go to March 31st, 1985. Barry, did you know in Madison Square Garden they had a series of matches that night that they called WrestleMania 1? And believe it or not, the main event, the Hulkster and Mr. T, apparent longtime schoolboy chum, faced off with Rowdy Roddy Piper and Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff. Barry, you had a chance to watch this match. Tell us if you thought this was a match of the year candidate.
So is it a match of the year candidate from the in-ring action? No, it's not. Is it a match of the year candidate from the hype and the spectacle of it? Yeah, it absolutely is. And to that end, it's actually a decent match. And I think that, you know, and certainly I'm guilty of it, Jeff. You're definitely guilty of it. We look at WWF in the mid-80s, and a lot of it was garbage. But I think we look at the product overall and we say it was garbage because you and I, as a lot of our listeners probably were, we were NWA guys. And these were the outsiders. This was the spectacle. This was the fluff. This wasn't the in-ring action. These guys weren't having, you know, four-star matches, you know, Midnight Express versus Arn and Tully or something like that. That being said, this is actually a really fun match, and you got to give everybody involved with this credit. You know, Piper and Orndorff come out to these bagpipe players and drummers, and it's such a spectacle. I don't think, you know, now we see this, you know, now with WrestleMania every year, these entrances are absolutely huge and they're grandiose, but back then this was big, and you know, the fans are up in arms, and as I watch Piper and Orndorff walk to the ring, there's fans literally putting the finger right in Piper's face. I just think, you know, it was real heat and it was real fun. Billy Martin, from the New York Yankees, the legendary Billy Martin was the guest ring announcer for the match. And I don't think in the history of ring announcing that anybody has ever dubbed as piss poor a job as Billy Martin did.
He was no Howard Finkel, I can tell you that.
he was no Lillian Garcia. he was terrible. So Hogan and Mr. T come out with Snuka, which I think in hindsight I find kind of interesting. The refs are Muhammad Ali, strategically assigned to the outside of the ring, and the veteran Pat Patterson, who will be at CWF Legends Fan Fest 4 November the 3rd in Lutz, Florida. Pat Patterson was calling the in-ring action, and no doubt was really there to try to keep order and keep the guys, like, you know, going for the script or whatever they were doing at that point. There is a really funny thing in the beginning, and you can see the evolution of the WWF into the WWE and what it is currently. There's an old guy sweeping the ring apron during the introductions, and he's, as they're doing it, it's an old guy. He looks like he's 70 years old, and he's sweeping the ring apron and appears completely clueless. Well, it does turn into a little bit of an angle. Orndorff takes the broom and threatens Hogan and Mr. T with it and then snaps it in half. Liberace is the timekeeper for this event. This is interesting to me, and I think the WWE and WWF has always done this. They bring out celebrities, but they don't always bring out celebrities that, in my opinion, are going to connect to their audience. Like, there's a massive disconnect to that. Liberace, look, this was the premier entertainer of the 60s and 70s. At the same time, I don't know if people that are going to see a WrestleMania show want to see Liberace as the timekeeper. I think there's a disconnect with that. Everybody's in the ring, and it's breaking down, and the work is fun. You know, the work is good here. Muhammad Ali starts taking swings at people. He takes a swing at Bob Orton Jr., who's kind of outside the ring, and they pan over to Billy Martin, who's hysterically laughing. Like, Billy Martin is like, he's in on this. He's like going, you know what? Yeah. So here's another revelation. And I really like this match. I got to say, Mr. T was not terrible. You know, I think going back in my head, I built up that Mr. T should have never been allowed in the ring, that he was like this terrible. He was absolutely fine. He was doing body slams. He was doing a couple other things, you know, rudimentary. But at the same time, he really wasn't terrible. I've seen a lot worse celebrities try to get involved in wrestling, which I'll harken back, which is the first time I've ever said harken back, to Jay Leno. keeping Hulk Hogan in an armbar at a WCW pay-per-view like some 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, which I, to this day I still can't believe. But, Jeff, I have a question for you. As I'm watching this match, and I'm watching everybody involved, I got to see. I could see where Hogan was the guy. It made a lot of sense at that time. Pardon me. Mr. T, he was hot at this point. They obviously had a connection from the Rocky movie, and you know, the TV show A-Team was big, so I get that. Roddy Piper was a next level heel. Roddy Piper, if you ever question, and I think, you know, at least in my mind, Piper at the end of his career, he became, I don't want to say a joke because that's being a little harsh, but he definitely wasn't the Roddy Piper that we see here. When you see this Roddy Piper, this is a heel that could have main evented. He didn't have to even wrestle. He could have main evented in any territory, any promotion, anywhere. He was that good. But one thing stood out to me, Paul Orndorff. Did Paul Orndorff have what it took to be the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion? Now, I want to quantify that too. Were his in-ring skills and his look good enough to make him NWA World's Heavyweight Champion? I don't think from an interview he could do it, because as an interview, he wasn't good. But he certainly looked a part of a world champion, and his work in the ring was really right there as well.
Well, I'll tell you what I wrote down as I was making some notations about this match, is that Paul Orndorff, I'll throw it back to you, Barry, and I'll compare Paul Orndorff as a heel to someone that is a favorite of this podcast, and that's Joe LaDuke. What do you think the comparison would be to Joe LaDuke as the psycho heel to Paul Orndorff, psycho heel?
There's a possibility. I don't think we would have ever seen a psycho heel as the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion.
No, not necessarily that. I'm talking about, can you see the comparison that I'm making there? That Orndorff, he had some real intensity to him as the kind of on the edge heel there.
So yeah, he did. He would get pretty fired up, and I remember, like, his face would turn all red and the veins were popping. Joe LaDuke to me is always going to be a premier psycho heel and really could do it. I see Orndorff as kind of a guy that could come out in fancy robes. I don't want to say Ric Flair, you know, but a guy who could come out well dressed. His physique was second to none. He had an incredible physique. Looks like he's got, like, just like me, 2% body fat. You know, it just, everything there, a really, really good wrestler. I think the one downfall, obviously, is his interviews, his promos. They were never good. But do you think that had Orndorff not made that jump, had he stayed with the NWA, do you think he ever could have been in consideration for the NWA World's Heavyweight title?
It's a good question. I would say, if it had been the mid-70s, I could see it, because, of course, they always wanted a guy that could take care of himself and could defend the reputation and the integrity of the belt. But I wonder whether or not, because, like you said, the interview – you know, we're talking about the interview skills. I have to tell you, one of my all-time favorite skits in WWE history is the deal where Paul Orndorff is at the gym training the young fans. And the girl comes up and tries to touch him on the arm. And he's, you know, you can never be like me. Don't ever touch me. And that's like one of the most hilarious skits ever. I could see Paul Orndorff like as a member of the Horsemen, you know, like not quite a world champion, but in that Tully Blanchard, Arn Anderson, you know, dare I say Barry Windham sort of range. Cause he was certainly good enough, but you know, let's put it this way. I could see Paul Orndorff, if the Horsemen had formed a couple years before, taking that Lex Luger spot and doing a much better job at it, by the way, because I think, you know, there was a time, let's just say 1980 to 1985, Paul Orndorff was really good. And then, of course, he had the unfortunate situation with his shoulder or his neck, where the nerves in his neck were all frayed. I don't know if it was from the steroids or years of lifting or what, but his shoulder was, you know, I'll never forget the story. I think I've mentioned it before on here. The time that Paul Orndorff came to a house show in Greensboro and John Hitchcock and Bruce Mitchell were giving him shit, and they were chanting out "Work the Good Arm." And Paul Orndorff looked over at him and goes, boy, you guys are cruel. You know, he was appreciating the way they were giving him shit about his arm. Anyway, so this match, what, again, was it a technically great match? This was not Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk Jr. It was goofy fun. You know, you mentioned the celebrities, Billy Martin, Muhammad Ali, Liberace. However, I really have an appreciation for just how, you know, we've talked about how much we can enjoy bad cinema. I really enjoy bad announcing, and Gorilla Monsoon was on his game as a bad announcer here. As Piper starts coming to the ring, Gorilla Monsoon announces that Roddy Piper's bagpipe intro is "My Bonnie Lassie's Coming Home to Me," that famous Scotland dirge, and that's what they're playing. And then he offers such gems as that Mr. T has an outstanding amateur background, and that Hogan has the power, Mr. T has the street sense, and that's why they make a great combination. So it was pretty over-the-top ridiculous, but there was some great stuff. Yeah, Paul Orndorff, Hulk Hogan went up for a suplex for Paul Orndorff. I mean, Hogan, he knew that he had to be the guy in this match for his team, and I give him credit. He was kind of working his ass off. This was something you usually didn't see in a Hulk Hogan match. There was another great moment where there was an eye gouge, and that Gorilla, I think it was Mr. T, did the eye gouge. He's street fighting. That's the way they fight in the streets. You know, you, Barry, of course, you can recall those fights as you were a kid when the eye gouge came into play, and that this match was action personified, according to Gorilla Monsoon. So they do the run. The match goes about 15 minutes. Orton comes in, does the run in. He's chased out by Snuka, comes back in, gets on the top rope with the cast, and hits Orndorff. Orndorff's knocked out. Piper and Orton leave. It sets up the next phase for Orndorff, which is a baby face, which was really good stuff because it led to his eventual heel turn again, and that was my favorite incarnation of Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff. So, yeah, this is a it's sort of like watching a bad movie. You know, you enjoy it for what it is. It's not a technical, you know, no technical brilliance involved, but it's, you know, it's dumb, stupid fun that you can enjoy. There's a whole generation of kids who started watching wrestling that really this was the apex. This was the beginning of a lot of people becoming wrestling fans because, of course, wrestling was being introduced to an entire new audience. And this was sort of the point, the demarcation point. Everything was, you know, before and after WrestleMania. And so many smart fans, I'll use that phrase, or longtime fans, as you discussed, we were NWA fans, of course, were completely horrified by this. This is not, you know, I don't recall Eddie Graham ever inviting Billy Martin or Liberace down to work a card for him. Let's just put it that way. But Vince was going a different way, and it was his own, you know, his own what's the word I'm looking for? His own vision of what pro wrestling was to become and has become. So, okay, Barry, now we're going to go way, way back on the old kayfabe meter. We're going to go to Tokyo, Japan, 1966. Again, I can't remember who posted this video, but it was a suggestion.
It was Tom Hale.
Okay, Tom Hale posted this. Shout out to Tom Hale. Thank you, Tom. Giant Baba versus Fritz Von Erich. Barry, did you have a chance to watch this match?
I did. So I went back and I watched it twice.
So why don't you tell us what you thought of it?
Absolutely. And why did I watch it twice, Jeff? Because this is not like the greatest match in the history. This is such a great look at what professional wrestling was like in the 60s and 70s, where if you had one hold or one maneuver, you could have 4,000 people, however many the Budokan holds, you could have every single person in that entire building waiting to see this one hold applied. And I'm talking about that one hold is the Iron Claw. So this was, I did a little bit of research on this, Jeff. This was the first professional wrestling card held at Budokan ever. And this was the main event, Giant Baba defending the international heavyweight title against Fritz Von Erich. It is such a unique match. And Fritz, you know, so Fritz was another guy that became, you know, you and I only knew Fritz as the father of the Von Erich boys. and he was kind of a caricature, kind of a cartoon of himself, certainly in the 1980s, and certainly, you know, what that family has been through. But at the same time, this is the first time I think that I've actually got a true good look at Fritz from the 1960s. He was a powerful, powerful heel, very threatening, very almost frightening, both with his presence and his voice, because you can hear him several times yelling in the ring. There's something he's got going on here. This is a serious, scary heel. The match is literally, it's a 25-minute match or so. The match is built around the Iron Claw, and that's it. And it's basically, can Fritz get the Iron Claw on Baba, and what is Baba going to do to prevent that? And there are times he gets it on, and then Baba is able to escape. But the Claw is being sold as the most dangerous hold ever. That's how I took it. Good to see that Baba was doing the Baba chops even back in 1966. Towards the end of the match, Fritz is abusing everybody. He's slapping, he bitch slaps the referee, and the referee goes down, and it's the short little chubby guy, and he's down. But then, like, all these seconds, I don't know if they're young boys, because no, they don't appear to be young boys, but all the ring seconds start coming in, and Fritz is laying them out, and he's punching everybody and kicking everybody. And at one point, one of these seconds, at least I think it's a second, it could be a fan, climbs on the second rope and starts to bite Fritz from behind. The heat is incredible. I mean, when you watch this, you know, you talk about a heel owning a building. This is it right here. So I went back and I also read 27 years after this match took place in 1993, Fritz and Baba stood in the ring in Budokan, and they shook hands. And it was a really important moment in Japanese history, Japanese wrestling history, being that this being the first main event in this building, and then for these two legends to be able to shake hands after. So I really did enjoy this match. This is a really unique look at how you can get, you know, a holdover. And this kind of reminds me, you know, and Johnny Valentine was somebody that I saw a few times, but I can't, you know, I was young, so I really can't tell you that I remember that much about Johnny Valentine, but all the stories are out there. And I'm not talking about the shitting an ice cube maker stories, or smearing his fecal matter all over hotel rooms. I'm talking about how he would basically work a hold for 20 minutes, and, you know, where fans nowadays would be chanting boring, boring, because nothing's happening. You know, everybody was sold into the hold that he was utilizing, and the fact that he could be crippling his opponent by utilizing this hold. So I really enjoyed this match. I really want to thank Tom Hale for putting this up there, and it kind of opened my eyes and said, you know what, maybe I need to go back and start watching more 1960s stuff. I certainly have watched a shitload of 1970s and going forward, 80s, 90s, and continuing even to this day, where, you know, I still watch wrestling, and or at least attempt to, but sometimes it's horrible. But this 60s stuff, I don't know. I think I'm going to do some research on this.
Well, here's the thing. As I started watching the match, as much as it was an interesting match to watch, I think the match in itself, it was one of those times where the match sets up the angle for what's to follow. And I can tell you that this angle that was in this match of, you know, as you said, putting over the devastation of the Iron Claw, this carried Fritz for the better part of over a decade in Japan. I mean, he was a main event heel for a decade against Baba, and it's what got his boys into Japan, because he became such a household name over in Japan. And this match was the precursor to all that. So I'm watching this match, and first of all, you have to admit that the technology in 1966 in Japan was quite a bit better than the stuff, you know, because you see something from the 60s, on a YouTube that's from the United States, and it does not look quite as pristine and clear as this match does. I mean, we're talking about a match that's 50 years ago, and it's not shot on movie footage. It looks like it's on video, and it's really pretty. It's black and white, but it's pretty good quality stuff. So the match starts off, Fritz attacks Baba. Baba goes down to a knee. Fritz kicks Baba. Now, when I say he kicks him, do I mean that he, like, puts the bottom of his foot on his back? No, I mean to tell you people, he fucking punts Baba in the chest to the point where you hear the boom of his foot kicking Baba in the chest. And I heard it. I went, holy shit. I mean, he really laid it into him. And it wasn't the only time that he kicked Baba. He kicked Baba at least 3 to 4 more times in the opening sequence. That was incredibly impressive. This is a, I believe it might have been a 2 out of 3 fall match, Barry, now that I remember. And you got color from Baba, from the claw. You got color from Fritz. I don't know if he was actually bit by the kick so long ago, or if he cut his own ear to get color. But like you said, the reaction from the crowd, this is something they'd never seen before, and they're going completely apeshit that their national hero, Showy Baba, is being attacked and just torn apart by this seeming rabid dog. Fritz Von Erich, the evil Nazi from Dallas, Texas, but that's another story. And it's just an incredible, I got to tell you, I'm watching Fritz. I'm going, holy shit. I can see why this guy drew great money. He was incredibly impressive. And he lived the gimmick. You know, we talk about guys that come out to the ring and they just live their gimmick. We discussed that last episode, and Fritz was living the gimmick. He was going out there and just beating the shit out of anybody that got near him. And it was all to get himself over. And guess what? He did one hell of a job getting himself over, because he did so well that he main evented there for the next better part of a decade based on the angles shot in this match. So you got to give him a lot of credit. The brawl at the end, absolutely insane. You know, with all the seconds and all the young boys, if that's what they were, jumping in to save Baba. And Baba does his interview after the match, and he's just like almost befuddled because of this, you know, this wave that just – that's what Fritz Von Erich was. He was like a wave at the beach that's just hit you and knocked you for a loop. Incredibly impressive performance. Thanks very much to Tom Haley for posting the video. And I got to be honest with you, when he first posted it, I was like, let me just watch a couple minutes of this. And I found myself watching the entire thing. It was really pretty compelling. It's not just great nostalgia. It's a time capsule. It really is of what wrestling was like in the 60s. And what's important about it is, like I mentioned, you don't see this kind of stuff from the mid to late 60s in this sort of quality. I mean, you're looking at something that is still, you know, A1 quality. And that's what I think makes it kind of an important piece of wrestling history to look at and observe and just get a look at what wrestling was like even before I became a fan, Barry.
Yeah, exactly, before either of us became fans, and it is pretty cool. And we should thank the Japanese. It's a wonderful country because, as you mentioned, the quality of this is astounding. And I've seen some 60s stuff from the U.S. It's nowhere near the quality that this is, but they preserve their stuff. Like, somehow they, you know, I don't know if it's being kept in the some sort of a chamber with the at the proper temperature, whatever it is, but they do a great job. And if you've ever seen these DVDs that they put out, and they used to put out these laser discs, I mean, boy, we're really dating ourselves there, but there was a Tiger Mask laser disc years ago, and my God, it was like the most high def you ever saw. Just fantastic. So I'm actually, you know, again, thanks to Tom and this match, I'm going to go back and I'm actually going to look for a lot more 1960s stuff. It was kind of cool too, because when you pull this match up on YouTube, there are at least 2 more Baba versus Fritz matches that also come up from the 1970s. So I'm probably going to go back and watch those as well.
Okay, so now we're going to discuss something that recently on the board, our old friend John Doe started to try to stir the pot in the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network by comparing our show to another show, shall I say. But before we get there, there was another member of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, a Mr. James Cornette. I believe he's based in Louisville, Kentucky. Barry, he recently had some very, to us, controversial statements regarding one of your true heroes. Barry, he called Jumbo Tsuruta bland. Would you like to respond to Mr. Cornette?
I would like to respond, and I actually wish Jimmy was in our studio, in our palatial studio with us, so we could discuss it in person, because hopefully I could offend him and he would go off on an epic rant on me and my day would be made, but as not to be the case. So I did not get a chance to listen to it, but what I did do is I headed over to the Facebook group, All Japan Pro Wrestling Worldwide Fan Group. Jeff, are you a member there?
I'm not. I did not know there was there. I will have to try and...
Yeah, it is. Oh. So this is not the Eric Cholominski group. This one is strictly on All Japan. And so this was a big topic of discussion over there. And apparently, part of it was taken out of context. So I'll read you a couple of the comments here. And there are a lot of people that are just completely trashing Cornette. One guy said, well, if Ceruta had a mullet and a Confederate flag, then Cornette would like him. That is kind of funny. But no, it's so this one guy posted said, everyone needs to get their panties out of a twist. He basically says he wasn't into him at first, but Jumbo grew on him. We've all had wrestlers who weren't fans of, but later liked. Carry on, people, nothing to see here. So apparently he did say that at first he found him boring, but then came to say that, that, you know, he could recognize his talent. And I think what he was saying was, if I go through all this, there's a lot of comments on here, is that he wasn't so much of a fan of Jumbo in the earlier days in the 1980s, but by the 1990s, he was a big fan and understood the greatness of Jumbo Ceruta. So I think it is much ado about nothing. This all goes back to what we talked about for like 12 hours on last week's episode that, you know, look, I might like Coffee Crunch ice cream and you might hate it. You don't like salads, and I love salads. You don't drink coffee, right, Jeff?
No, I do not.
I could not live without coffee. At the same time, it's whatever you like. It's, you know, this is all opinion. You know, Billy Joel, my God, did that created a little bit of a controversy. When I said about Billy Joel. Just a little bit. I won't even start with Motorhead, Chris. So, you know, it was, you know, look, it's an opinion. At the end of the day, it's, you know, because I don't like it and you like it, more power to you. I don't want to change your mind. Jim Cornette doesn't like Jumbo Ceruta. He's insane. But I'm not going to change his mind, you know?
Chris Zaha loved the fact that I brought up Rosalinda's eyes. So
he loved that fact. And you know what? God bless him, because he seemed like he was truly hurt, and I just wanted to hold him in my arms and tell him everything was going to be all right. Between you beating up Kevin Nash, I took a shot at the Steiner brothers, and then Billy Joel. And I was very gentle about Billy Joel. I didn't go off. But, yeah, I felt that Chris needed a little bit of love. So, Chris, we love you. Everything will be all right.
All right, now let's go to another topic that was recently on our board. That this is, I think, a good topic for discussion. I believe is our old friend Kevin Orcutt, who mentioned that he got into wrestling relatively later than some of the people on the board. And when he started getting into wrestling, Chris Benoit maybe had, now that I'm trying to remember, I don't know if he said he got into wrestling after the incident or just before. So it brought up the whole topic of Chris Benoit. The horrible, horrible act that he perpetrated on his wife and son. Can it affect your ability to watch and enjoy a Chris Benoit match? And Barry, I know that you have been quoted in the past as saying you can't watch Chris Benoit. So first of all, before we begin this, let me just say, nobody's right or wrong on this. It's at least, like you said about Jumbo Ceruta, you can either like the guy or not. I'm talking about his matches. I think everyone can agree that what happened was completely horrible that day. The loss of two lives. There's really, I can't think of much worse than being a child killer, especially your own child. And whether he did that, you know, with a premeditated act or whether it was, you know, a symptom of his, let's be honest, his damaged brain at that point. But Barry, here's what I was trying to equate it to. Watching Chris Benoit, if you go back and watch a Chris Benoit match, if you did, the question that I guess I wonder, and I'm comparing apples and oranges here. I'm not equating to what this person did to what Chris Benoit did. But, you know, you think about, like, think about baseball. And my wife, I was asking my wife about it. And my wife said, well, you know, there are some people that, you know, they're so bitter about what happened with Pete Rose that they can't ever imagine wanting Pete Rose to be in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, you go back on ESPN Classic and they show baseball games. And, you know, does the fact that Pete Rose is supposedly have done this thing that is the ultimate sin in baseball, will it affect your ability to sit and watch a Pete Rose game, an old game with Pete Rose in it? So that being said, is what's happened with Chris Benoit so bad? You know, I know they pulled his name off the WWE network. His matches are still there, but you have to look, you kind of have to backdoor into him. You have to look up the other person's name to get to the Chris Benoit match. So that being said, is it forever? We can't enjoy a Chris Benoit match anymore, Barry?
Again, this is strictly just going to be my opinion and how everybody deals with this. Here's the thing. It's not like I'm taking some sort of moral stance when I say I can't watch a Chris Benoit match. We can all agree, and you just said it, Jeff, and everybody basically does agree with this. What Chris Benoit did was, you know, it's one thing to kill yourself, but when you kill your wife, when you kill a small, defenseless child an innocent child, there are a few things worse than that. So here's the deal. When Chris Benoit killed himself, I was very much, I know exactly where I was when I heard about it. I came home, I watched Raw that night, and I was devastated because Chris Benoit was probably my favorite active wrestler at the time. The guy, you know, he couldn't have a horrible match. It wasn't possible. Chris Benoit was great. When it came out he killed his kid, I couldn't watch his matches. But again, it wasn't that I put myself on some moral high ground where I'm too good to watch the matches. What happened was I couldn't watch a match because all I saw when I'm watching the match and all I'm thinking about is this guy killing his kid. So, you know, if you want to watch a Chris Benoit match and you can get past that, more power to you. I don't think that there's an issue if you want to go ahead and watch that. You know, again, it's what he did is it's historical. He wrestled for years. He wrestled for 15, 20 years. There are records of his matches. You should be able to watch those. Personally, I can't. It's very similar. You know, I tried to, The Usual Suspects was on the other night, and I was watching it, and when Kevin Spacey comes on, all I see is essentially an alleged child molester, you know, and alleged by dozens of people at this point. So I can't separate what they do. It doesn't, again, it isn't like I don't want to change what anybody else does. More power to you. You know, if you can do that, that's great. I can't. You know, there's several of these people. Look, one of my favorite movies, and when we did our top 10 movies, Jeff, which is probably 7-8 months ago, Return of the Living Dead was right there. Well, facts came out, and one of the actors that was in Return of the Living Dead went to jail for abusing a child. And I can't watch the movie now without looking. I don't see the character. I see the guy who molested a child, and it's very difficult for me to be able to separate that. So I will say this though: our Facebook group, these guys are fucking rock stars. So you know that I admin in several other wrestling groups. I run my own wrestling group, and invariably, anytime anything about Kevin Sullivan or a woman, Nancy Benoit, comes up, there's one fucking moron who always comes in there that said Kevin Sullivan killed Nancy Benoit and the kid. And there are people out there, Jeff, and I'm not making this up because I know you've seen this, there are people that legitimately believe that Kevin Sullivan snuck into the house of Chris Benoit and murdered the entire family. Not one person in our group even went in that direction in any form yesterday. And so, quite frankly, that you get a standing ovation for me on that one.
You know, here's the thing. I really wonder, and I'll just take this in a slightly different direction. You know, Chris Benoit, I wonder if the people that still feel that they can watch a Chris Benoit match and not let that seep into their subconscious, the horrible act that he perpetrated. I wonder in some regards, tell me what you think about this. You know, Chris Benoit was, let's face it, Barry, he was a great wrestler. Taking everything else out of the context, he was a tremendous wrestler, had great matches with a lot of different guys. If you're talking instead about a guy like, I'll throw a name out just because he's pretty much known as being a horrible wrestler. Somebody like the Mighty Zulu, okay, regarded as one of the all-time worst, or Mighty Igor maybe, okay, bad wrestlers. If those guys had done it and people are outraged because they had murdered a child, are people going to be able to say, oh, no, we're definitely not watching this match, as opposed to the people who are like, well, he's horrible for what he did, and he murdered his kid, but by God, his matches were still great, and I want to watch those. I mean, do you get the point I'm making?
Yeah, and there are. So there are certain people that are, you know, whether you're callous or indifferent to the fact that he did it, they're like, I don't care. These are same people that fucking torture kittens. So, yeah, so that's I absolutely get exactly what you're saying, and these people do exist, you know, sadly.
And,
these people,
you know, one of the things I want to mention is that, you know, my friend Tom Nash, the original Blackheart, knew Chris Benoit from an incident that happened, I believe, in Philadelphia. I'm talking like maybe 93, 94, at a Joel Goodhart show. He was involved in an altercation with Chris Benoit, where the two of them had to be separated in a dressing room over a, you know, kind of a nothing happened incident. And he told me, he said, you know, Chris Benoit was really an asshole. He wasn't a nice guy. And this was, what, 10, 15 years before that happened, he was telling me that this guy was an asshole. Now, I met Chris Benoit when he was a young guy over in Japan when I went on a tour over there with Dave Meltzer in the December of 1987. He was working in New Japan as Dynamite Chris. He was a young guy just getting his start in the business. And he seemed perfectly fine to me. But of course, this was before all the alleged head trauma. You know, he didn't present himself as an a-hole to me like he did my friend Tom Nash. So which was the real Chris Benoit? Was it the guy that Eddie Guerrero loved? Or was it the guy that Tom Nash thought was a complete fucking asshole? Who knows? Maybe it was somewhere in between. But I find it interesting that people can sit there and maybe these are the same people that don't have a problem watching old Buffalo Bills games and watching OJ run wild, you know, when he was the greatest back in the league. The other thing I want people to consider, you know, one of the things that I found out early on as a wrestling fan, and especially somebody who started becoming more involved in the Wrestling Observer back in the late 80s and getting deeper into the wrestling business. Here's something you may not know. There are a lot of really scummy people that have been involved in the wrestling business. Wrestling business not that far removed from the film business that Barry just referenced with Kevin Spacey. There are guys that we've discussed on this show that were alleged to have perpetrated some pretty, what's the word, sketchy things in their life. And people tend to look the other way. Oh, but he has great matches. He does good interviews. And you're not looking at the fact that this person was alleged to have done something that probably should have gone to jail for, Barry.
So I'm going to throw two out there that are deceased, and I believe these are alleged, but it's out there. So Grizzly Smith and Bruiser Bob Sweetan. And there are some horrible stories. I don't think we need to go into it. You can Google it. It's all out there. But at the same time, I'm not going to sit here and watch their matches either. Because, you know, based off of, you know, and I believe Sweetan went to jail for it and then was deported from the U.S. So he certainly is a convicted felon based off of what he did. But, yeah, I'm not going to watch their matches. And, you know, and Jimmy Snuka is another one, you know, and Travis Reigns or somebody brought that up. And they made a great point that he almost gets a free pass because he's Superfly. And he was never convicted, though a lot of the evidence seems to point in that direction. And then he died. But, you know, look, You can like and dislike, and certainly in any facet, whether it's OJ, as you mentioned, whether it's rock and roll music. I mean, there are some stories out there about musicians as well, which are exactly that are absolutely horrific. So I think there's a level, and I think at some point you've got to say, okay, this guy, you know, maybe he did something wrong, and you have to determine, you know, is that enough for you to not do it? For me, again, you know, I can't watch a Chris Benoit match because literally there's no enjoyment in watching the match. I just see a guy that wound up killing his child. So it's, so, you know, so, but I'm not going to judge people who do. I hate the comments, or I should say I strongly dislike the comments when people are trying to justify why they do it. And then, you know, some asshole always says, well, Kevin Sullivan is really the true killer or something stupid like that. But, you know, if you can put aside what Chris Benoit did and watch a match, I'm not going to come down on you for it.
Well, let me put it, since you brought it up, does stories that you've heard about people in music, if you've heard some story about somebody in music who maybe was alleged to have raped somebody, physically assaulted somebody, or just been a general overall asshole, because Lord knows there's those out in the music industry too. Does that affect your ability to listen to the music and you know, maybe to a song of a particular artist?
Yeah, it does sometimes too. And I find that the older that I get, so it is funny, when I was younger, you know, I remember like watching like all like these like death videos and all that shit that we do. And now I have zero desire, you know, like there'll be these ISIS videos that'll pop up on my newsfeed. I have zero desire to watch people die or anything like that. So I think partly it's age, but there's a certain morality that comes as you get older, and you raise a family and you're an adult. And I can't. And honestly, my world has gotten smaller because of it. There are certain, you know, musicians that I might not listen to. There are certain actors that I won't see their movies. And it's not like I want to fucking, you know, bang on my chest and tell you that I'm this, you know, this moral, you know, soapbox guy. That's not it. It's just, you know, I just can't do it. And I don't have a desire to do it. And the truth is, there's plenty going on right now, Jeff. As I almost cursed you last night when you said, I talked with you last night, and then you said, "Have you watched The Staircase?" And then I find myself at 11 o'clock last night watching The Staircase on Netflix, and I'm going, "Fucker, I have to go to bed. I'm tired. I can't." It's a great, you know, it's great. So the point is, my world gets smaller because, yes, if I hear that a certain musician did something, and I don't just mean the typical asshole, because look, we're all assholes to some degree. I get that. But, you know, if you're talking to guys, a convicted rapist or a convicted serial rapist, they're, you know, in football. I mean, my God, Jeff, you're a huge football fan. You know, Kellen Winslow Jr. I mean, you know, really? Like, when you hear this story, you go, "Oh my God!" You know, and obviously he's never going to play football again. But if I was a diehard football, do you ever go back and do you ever watch games? And I know you do, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Fortunately, yeah, I don't go back and watch Miami games, but that's
Kellen Winslow Jr. games. I get that, but
I'm a soldier.
But it's the same token. Yeah, yeah. But my guess is you go back and you probably watch Notre Dame games.
Sure,
and
sure.
Had Kellen Winslow gone to school at Notre Dame, which he didn't, and we're hearing the stories of what he's done, which really these stories are horrific, you know, would that have impacted your ability? It might have, right? I mean, some degree.
And, you know, yeah. As we're recording, there's a current, you know, and I say this because this won't come out for another few days. You know, one of the big stories right now in the NFL is the looming suspension for Jameis Winston, the quarterback for the Bucks, over allegations that he either sexually assaulted or grabbed in an inappropriate way. I believe it was an Uber driver. And this is not, shall I say, the first time that he's been in the news for something of this nature or other criminal incidents. So, you know, and one of the discussions, as I listen to the Pro Football Talk podcast every day, is, does there come a point in time when the Tampa Bay Buccaneers decide that they're going to cut Jameis Winston loose because he's just too much bad news for the franchise? So that's absolutely a valid point. Now, folks, it is time for our top five. Since we were just talking about scandalous activity there, we will now continue the scandal, the sleaze, the dirt, the muck, the sex. Yes, it's time for top five Hollywood scandals. Now, are these the, you know, first of all, folks, we're not going Roseanne Barr saying something idiotic. We're not going to go Mel Gibson saying something idiotic. Dare I say, we're not going to go Peter Fonda saying something idiotic. No, we're being non-political here. We're going to talk about sex and murder. Who doesn't love a good sex and murder story, right, Barry? So what we've done is we've gone and we've looked at, we're going to look at five famous Hollywood-related cases involving sex and or murder. For those of you out there waiting for us to discuss Biggie and Tupac, the answer is not on this particular show, maybe in the future. So the first case we're going to talk about, Barry, we referenced this before. We are going back to, good Lord, this may be our furthest back reference ever, 1947, Barry.
Wow.
The Black Dahlia, Elizabeth Short. On January 15th, 1947, 22-year-old Elizabeth Short's body was found. Barry, she was cut in frigging half. Found in a lot in Los Angeles. Her body had been drained of blood. She had been cut in half with surgical precision. Her face, her mouth had been cut so that when the police found her, her face had been cut into to a smile, almost like the Joker in Batman, some kind of sleazy shit like that. Barry, tell us some cursory knowledge you have of this case, because it's a real famous case. Believe it or not, it's over, good Lord, I'm trying to think here, 70 years old. The case is still open, Barry.
Yeah, in this case will be open up forever. Or at least we think it will, because with all the new DNA and evidence and everything that's coming out now, things could change. But so as you mentioned, Elizabeth Short, she was fairly new to Los Angeles. She was kind of a party girl. She had been arrested for underage drinking. She had several male suitors. Apparently was not easy with her body, though. She was keeping a lot of these suitors at bay, but she was found, as you said, in a vacant lot in Los Angeles in 1947 by a dog walker and her daughter, who initially thought the corpse was a discarded mannequin. As you said, she really didn't look human. She had been drained of all of her blood. She had been scrubbed meticulously, cut in half at the waist, and then posed naked. Further investigation revealed ligature marks, evidence of torture, and as you said, a Joker-like smile where her face was cut ear to ear, and they call it the Glasgow smile, Jeff. This case riveted Hollywood at the time and continues to rivet Hollywood some 70 years later.
And apparently, 9 days later, the Los Angeles Examiner, the newspaper, received a package which contained Elizabeth Short's Social Security card, her birth certificate, and an old address book. The killer was taunting the cops in L.A., Barry.
Yeah, he was. And here's the thing, too. So if you've – and I think everybody knows about this case. How much you know is a whole different story. But to some degree, I think everybody knows about this case. But did you know that at the same time this was happening, essentially – which I should say was about 10 years earlier, there were similar murders called the Cleveland Torso Murders taking place in Cleveland, Ohio, and they're very, very similar. And this was something that, you know, I think everybody knows if you follow this at all, the name George Hodel. He is considered the number one suspect, he and his friend Fred Sexton. But these murders were taking place, and then there was a murder, Jeff, in February 10th, 1947 in Los Angeles, and possibly connected to the Black Dahlia killing, the murder of Jean French. Her body was discovered in West Los Angeles on Grandview Boulevard, nude and badly beaten. Written on her stomach in lipstick, what appeared to say, "Fuck you, BD," and the letters text below, T-E-X. The Herald Express covered the story heavily and drew comparisons to the Short murder less than a month prior, surmising the initials BD to stand for Black Dahlia. So very, very interesting here. There is an author named Steve Hodel, and you're familiar with Steve Hodel?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, here's the story. First of all, let me just mention that Elizabeth Short apparently stayed at the Biltmore Hotel. There are stories that exist that Elizabeth Short's ghost – I know you're a big believer in ghosts, Barry – that her ghost haunts the Biltmore Hotel. George Hodel was a guy who was one of the suspects. Here's a dead giveaway if you're ever a suspect in a murder. If the police find out that you have a, quote, secret room in your house – Barry, that's usually a tip-off that you're doing something nefarious. Steve Hodel's son, George Hodel's son, Steve, was an L.A. cop for 25 years who, after retiring, began investigating the case. And lo and behold, Pierre's dear old dad may have been involved and was a suspect. It was learned that George Hodel was a very educated man who had been trained in surgical techniques. He ran, Barry, did you hear this one? He ran the VD clinic in Hollywood. That may have been where he ran into Elizabeth Short or some other women. One of the reasons that he was alleged to have been involved in the incident is apparently the police, in believing that George was a suspect, wiretapped his house. And he was quoted as saying on the wiretap, "Suppose I did kill Dahlia. They can't prove it because my secretary is dead," unquote. Wow, that's pretty damning evidence right there, Barry.
Yeah, it absolutely is, too. So there are so many twists and turns in the Black Dahlia case. And to me, it may be the most interesting Hollywood scandal in the fact that when you go back and you read all these stories. In 1991, a woman who was 10 years old at the time of Short's murder, named Janice Knowlton, claimed that she witnessed her father, George Knowlton, beat Short to death with a claw hammer in their garage of their home in Westminster, California. She wrote a book about it, and that right there is always a little suspect to me. It's one thing if you claim that you know something and you don't want to benefit from it financially, but if you're you're writing a book and then you're going on a book tour, it does make it a little suspect. But when you go through the list of suspects, there's probably somewhere 15 to 20 suspects, and they all have a backstory behind it. There was another murder. There was a place called the Hollywood Canteen, and a woman, her name was Georgette Bauerdorf. She was a socialite who was strangled in her home, and apparently there's a connection between the two women, the Black Dahlia and this woman, Bauerdorf. So there's all these different, but the Hodel thing that you brought up, he really has been the prime suspect for many, many years. And I know that they were trying to tie him into these Cleveland murders that took place as well.
Well, first of all, let me just say that one of the problems with solving the case that has happened over the years is basically all the physical evidence in the case over the course of time has disappeared, which that's a really good reason for the case to stay open. Another problem that has been identified in the case is, here's a stunning development. There was a lot of corruption going on in the police force back in the late 40s. As recently as 2003, the Los Angeles district attorney, when looking at the case, said, quote, "I would file against George Hodel if it had happened today." So George Hodel seems to be, and just as a reference point, you know, Barry, when I looked at Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia, I'll tell you the face that comes to mind when I see her, if people are looking for comparison, she to me looks a little like the actress Elizabeth McGovern. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. I love Elizabeth McGovern.
Yeah, she was in.
Absolutely.
What's that? No, not. That's Elizabeth Montgomery.
Oh. Elizabeth McGovern from Ragtime.
Wow, that's going to be a shirt.
Here Racing comes with the Moon.
Yes, yeah. And she was in Ordinary People. She was but a very well-known actress for a while. And that's sort of who she reminds me of a little bit. Okay, Barry, next we are going to go to one of America's favorite TV stars from the late 70s. We're talking tough guy Beretta, Robert Blake. And in 1999, he met his wife, Bonnie Lee Bakley, in 1999 in an L.A. nightclub. They were married. It was a very tempestuous relationship. As apparently, Barry, from what I've done research-wise, Bonnie had a bit of a sketchy past. She was known to be a bit of a grifter. Apparently, she liked to prey on older wealthy men in her past. She'd been arrested a few times for a shoplifting and general theft charge. Robert, of course, it was a kind of oil and water. He had a bit of a reputation as a hothead. I don't know if you remember that part of him. Bonnie was his second wife. She, besides the theft I mentioned, she had a history of stalking former boyfriends and general overall creepy behavior. So here we go. It's May 4th, 2001. And they're at Vitello's, which is an Italian restaurant that Robert Blake was known to frequent in the Los Angeles area. And Bonnie, shall I say, met her untimely demise, Barry.
Yeah, so they were in Vitello's restaurant on Tahunga Avenue in Studio City. And that's actually prior to this, I mean, certainly is now, it's a kind of a semi-famous Italian restaurant in the area where a lot of the heavy hitters went. People who were connected, so mafiosa types went there. So they went to dinner there. Bakley was killed by a gunshot wound to the head while sitting in her car, which was parked on a side street around the corner from the restaurant. Here's the interesting thing about her. So you just kind of mentioned about her sketchy past. Her sketchy past could literally take the next 6 hours of this show. The woman was married 9 times prior to Robert Blake, making that 10 marriages, Jeff. Jeff, that would be you, Lederberg, and who else? Who else could we throw in there?
Well, I don't think we need to get that particular about it. You know, the woman, she was just looking for Mr. Wright. She was in her own way. She was looking for Mr. Goodbar.
She was looking for something, but apparently, yes. So she was married 10 times. She was known as a grifter, as you said. She would take nude photos of herself and send these to men for money. There were allegations of prostitution. She had been, if I'm correct, arrested on alcohol and or drug charges previously. But this woman had quite a vibrant past. She had 4 children, a son and a daughter. She had a daughter named Jerry Lee Lewis, spelled J-E-R-I. Allegedly, the father was the famous Jerry Lee Lewis, but I don't know if there was ever a test or anything ever done. And then she had a daughter named Rose with Christian Brando. Now, Christian Brando, that's a whole nother fucking scandal, because that was the one that killed his sister's boyfriend. If you remember that one, the beautiful Cheyenne Brando.
I can't believe we're not including that scandal. That's how good it was.
Well, we're throwing in a sixth one, right? Exactly. Bonus time, bonus scandal time on Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry. So yeah, and that one, so Christian Brando killed the boyfriend, Dag Drolet, who was dating Cheyenne, and because I think he said that he saw him beating her. She said that never happened, and then she committed suicide just a month or two after that happened, which was just a real tragedy. So the story here, she had a daughter, and the daughter was initially Christian Brando's child. As it turns out, a DNA test was done, and no, Robert Blake was the father of the child. So they had named the child Christian Shannon Brando. When it turned out that Robert Blake was the father, they renamed her Rose Lenore Sophia Blake. Oh my God! I mean, you talk about fucked up.
That's a definite oops moment there, Robert.
Oh yeah, yeah. So she was involved with Christian Brando, obviously having sex with Christian Brando and Robert Blake. When the baby was born, she told Blake that she was unsure who the father was. They did the paternity test, and I think this was really the impetus of why Blake actually married this woman. So when they got married, Blake forced Bakely, and I don't know if force is the right word, but I'm sure that's it, forced her to sign a temporary custody agreement. And it said under the agreement that Bakely agreed to monitored visits with Rose and to get written permission for her friends and family to visit Blake's property. The agreement also stipulated that if either spouse decided to end the marriage, the other spouse would retain custody of Rose. So, yeah, that just seems a little odd. Bakely and Blake were married in November of 2000, and within, 6 months, she took a bullet to the head. So, really interesting. They also never lived together. Bakely and Rose lived in a small guest house beside Blake's house in the San Fernando Valley. The relationship, Jeff, hard to believe, was reportedly rocky. Blake was distrustful of Bakely and hired a private investigator to find more information about her. Blake later found out that Bakely had continued to operate her Lonely Hearts ad scam during the marriage, which is basically where she's reaching out to these rich men. So she was quite the character here.
Yeah, I got to just real quick say that nothing puts a damper on a marriage like you having a Lonely Hearts column looking for other people outside the marriage. So here's the thing. The night of the incident, what really struck me was as they're walking out to the car, they get to the car and Robert Blake utters this immortal phrase to his spouse at the time. Oh, honey, I forgot my gun in the restaurant. I got to go back and get my gun I left on the table. Robert Blake was packing heat that night, eating Italian food. So the story goes, according to Robert Blake, he goes back into the restaurant, comes back out to the car. Lo and behold, there's poor Bonnie with the old bullet in her head. So she's lying there dead. Robert, instead of running back immediately to the restaurant, runs to the nearest house. Help, help. I need the police. Then he turns around, runs to the restaurant. Help, help. I need the police. By the way, this is also kind of a very dark humor here, but he says, help, help, I need police. Can I get a drink of water, by the way? So he had to throw in that he needed a drink of water. So
He was thirsty.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nothing makes you thirsty like allegedly killing someone. Notice I said allegedly. So the question, of course, is, was Bonnie trying to somehow blackmail or scam Robert Blake? She had done it before, so there's always a possibility. So what happens is on April 18th, 2002, Blake is arrested for the charge, quote, murder under specific circumstances. So in December of 2004, a 10-week trial begins, which include testimony from two men who claimed they were recruited by Robert Blake to kill Bonnie. A total, Barry, of 100 witnesses were brought in to testify in the matter, Good Lord Almighty. All I can think of when I see cases like this is the poor clerk. There are so many pieces of evidence. You know, I'm going back to my job, Barry. How does this affect the clerk? So he ends up walking on the murder charge, gets acquitted, crying and sniffling because, you know, poor Robert Blake has been exonerated. But of course, much like happened in OJ, you know, with the OJ trial, a year later, a civil case is, pursued. Of course, for those of you unaware, the standard of proof is much different in a civil case than in a murder case. In a murder case, it's beyond all reasonable doubt. You've watched the TV shows and heard that one. However, in a civil case, it's basically what they call the old preponderance of the evidence. 51-49, you win. And so the civil jury awarded a settlement to, I don't know if it was, as a matter of fact, I think one of them was Bonnie Blakely's daughter, Robert Blake's daughter, got some money from dad because he allegedly, according to the civil case, had killed mom. $30 million to her heirs. So Robert apparently had held on to some of that Beretta money. Barry.
Well, so we're clear. The jury ordered Blake to pay $30 million.
That's true.
That doesn't mean right.
Yes,
right. That doesn't mean he's got $30 million. But they also, on April 26, 2008, an appeals court upheld the civil case verdict, and they cut Blake's penalty assessment in half. So it wound up being $15 million, and it was Blakely's three eldest children, if I'm correct, or three eldest daughters. So yeah, a really interesting story, this whole thing. There's no doubt in my mind that apparently he hired a guy named Earl Caldwell, who was a stuntman buddy, and this was the guy responsible for the murder. This is like a typical mafioso type hit. Blake was apparently connected as well. He goes, oh yeah, I left my gun in the restaurant. He goes back in the restaurant and he comes back out and his wife is dead. She's been shot in the head. So it's a hit. It's 100% hit. He definitely ordered the hit. And this guy named Earl Caldwell, longtime friend, stuntman, I guess they called his girlfriend up on the stand and they asked her a question and they basically said, do you believe that these two were involved with this crime? And tears filled her eyes as she paused for what seemed like a decade, then leaned into the microphone and said that yes, she did believe that they were involved. Los Angeles District Attorney Steve Cooley commented on the ruling when Blake got off for the murder, calling Blake a miserable human being and the jurors incredibly stupid. I love that. I like when a district attorney goes for it. So
I got to tell you, if you want to have some fun, go on YouTube and type in Robert Blake's interview. He did an interview with Piers Morgan that is every bit the equivalent of a Billy Jack Haynes interview with RF Video, where he just starts rambling, and it's sort of, I don't want to say sad, pathetic, hilarious at the same time, because this guy is just out there with some of the stuff he believes, the conspiracy theory that he offers on this case. So yeah, the Piers Morgan interview with Robert Blake is quite the interesting one to check out. Okay, Barry, now we are going to take our podcast to June 29th, 1978, Scottsdale, Arizona, Barry. It is the death of Bob Crane. Bob Crane, of course, known to me very well as the star of Hogan's Heroes, which I've gone on the record of saying as a kid was my favorite show. I still occasionally will go on YouTube and check out a Hogan's Heroes episode if I'm really bored. It's such a great, ridiculous show. Bob Crane was found dead in a hotel room, cord wrapped around the neck. Here's something really twisted, Barry. So I go on YouTube and I'm looking up some background details on it. There is a YouTube, apparently, I want to say about 2 years ago, some TV station in the Scottsdale area was doing a retrospective on the case. And they're talking about all the new ways that police have the technology where they can do the DNA testing to go back and look at various trace evidence. And they're going back and they're interviewing all these people. Well, amongst the things that are shown on this is the coroner's video of them shaving Bob Crane's head, his corpse, to discover where the wounds are on his scalp and head, and they're removing the cord from around his bloody neck. Oh my God, Barry, I started watching that and I was like, holy shit. Crazy, crazy. Tell us what you know about Bob Crane's death, Barry.
Yeah, so this is one. I mean, this is where the sex comes into play when we're talking about Hollywood scandals. So Bob Crane, obviously Hogan's Heroes, at this point of his life, 1978, he had had a failed TV show, I think 3 or 4 years earlier, 13 or 14 episodes canceled. He was doing, I think his last TV appearance was in 78, and it was an episode of The Love Boat. But at this point, he was doing like dinner theater. And he was in a very unglamorous apartment in Scottsdale, Arizona. Have you ever been to Scottsdale, Jeff?
I have not.
I think one of our listeners, I think it's Andrew Betts. I don't know if he lives in Scottsdale or he's in Phoenix, but man, in the middle of summer, I was in Arizona a couple of times. The middle of summer, you have never felt heat like that. And everybody will say, well, it isn't humid. Yeah, it's 130 degrees. It doesn't have to be humid, you know? It's insane. But anyways, June 1978, Crane is living at these Winfield Place apartments in Scottsdale. They're not glamorous. And he's doing a play called Beginner's Luck at the Windmill Dinner Theater. On the afternoon of June 29th, Crane's co-star, Victoria Ann Barry, enters his apartment after he fails to show up for a lunch meeting and discovers the body. Crane had been bludgeoned to death with a weapon that was never identified, though investigators believed it to be a camera tripod. An electrical cord had been tied around his neck. Really interesting, because when the police started inspecting, they didn't realize what they were going to find. So, you know, this to them was, oh my God, the guy from Hogan's Heroes has been killed. The next thing you know, they're discovering all these fucking videotapes that this guy was making his own pornography. So this was the subject of a movie that came out, and I believe it was called Autofocus with Greg Kinnear in 2002. And it's in from what I know about this case, there's a lot of fictionalization of that movie. There's the part where they talked about the penile implant. Apparently that never happened. But you just talked about this previously, you know, with I believe it was our last case. But the Scottsdale Police Department had no homicide division, and they were ill-equipped to handle a high-profile murder investigation. So the crime scene really didn't give them any clues, really. I mean, it really didn't give you any clues. No evidence of forced entry was found. Nothing of financial value was missing. But they did find this videotape collection, apparently very extensive. And that led them to John Carpenter, not to be confused with the fantastic movie director of Halloween and The Thing and Escape from New York. He's done some Big Trouble in Little China. I can go on about John Carpenter. Totally different guy, though. But anyways, this guy had flown to Phoenix just a few days earlier to spend days with Crane. Carpenter's rental car was impounded and searched. And guess what? Several blood smears were found that matched Crane's blood type. That's a coincidence, right? No one else was known to have been in the car, including Carpenter, and they tested for that type. I guess DNA testing was not yet available. So as this went on, and this went on for about 2 or 3 years, in 1990, they actually opened up the case. They didn't have enough evidence to be able to prosecute Carpenter, though they felt that this was their guy. They just didn't have the evidence. So they persuaded the county attorney to reopen the case. DNA testing found blood in Carpenter's rental car was inconclusive. And Detective Jim Raines, I want you to pay close attention to that last name, Jim Raines, could be related to Travis, discovered an evidence photograph of the car's interior that appeared to show a piece of brain tissue. Now, Jeff, as you mentioned earlier, the actual tissue samples recovered from the car had been lost. Go figure. But an
Who amongst us? Does not have someone's brain tissue on the floor of their car. I ask you, Barry, why would that be suspicious?
And if you had brain tissue, of course you're going to lose it. It's not like you would want to hold on to brain tissue. But an Arizona judge ruled that the new evidence was actually admissible. And in 1992, June of 92, Carpenter was arrested and charged with Crane's murder. Do you know what happens from there?
Yes, I do. He goes to trial. He is acquitted by a jury in 1994. Acquitted. Now, here's what's interesting about John Carpenter. John Carpenter was a guy that Bob Crane obviously was a very into electronics, video, audio equipment. And he meets this guy, John Carpenter, many years before, who sort of leeches on to Bob Crane. Bob Crane, was still a Hollywood name at that point. His star had not begun to fade. And he and Bob Crane find they have a mutual hobby. They like to videotape, photograph, and tape themselves having sex with various women, dare I say, outside the bounds of the marital vows, Barry. So John Carpenter hooks up Crane with all this equipment. Now, after Bob Crane's body is found, what police found especially interesting was that John Carpenter essentially began setting up an alibi for himself. He would call and say, I'm just looking for Bob. While the police are in the house, the police answer the phone or the apartment. Yeah, hi, it's the Scottsdale PD. Can I help you? Oh, I'm just looking for Bob. Is he around? Can I talk to him? He never asked. By the way, when they say, this is a Scottsdale PD, Barry, you would think someone would go, really? Why is the police officers there in my friend's apartment? Doesn't bother to ask that. Flies back to L.A., okay? Blood in the rental car, as you said. He's arrested 14 years later. The marks on the body, as you said, indicative of perhaps an incident involving a tripod from some video equipment. Barry, I have to say, Bob Crane apparently had a very dark side. And I will say, a spoiler alert, we're going to discuss someone next who also apparently had a bit of a dark side. I would say that's a bit of an understatement. So they entered 2016, as I said, this TV station, I believe it might have been Scottsdale or one of the other cities in Arizona, are doing a retrospective on the killing. They're interviewing the defense attorney. They're interviewing the prosecutor, one of the investigative detectives, and they have a juror on there, okay? So they're talking about all this evidence. John Carpenter, by this point, has passed away. He passed away, I want to say, 2 or 3 years afterwards. One of the other people they're talking with is Bob Crane's son. Okay. So after they have the new way to look at DNA evidence, they look at it. They say, although there are, at this point, very trace amounts of evidence left remaining, it proved inconclusive, but they said they did not think it was John Carpenter. It was not Bob Crane's blood in John Carpenter's car. And I have to be honest with you, the station was completely stunned because they were expecting a woohoo, we solved the case kind of moment. So here's what's great. And you made mention, Barry, earlier of the who was it that had written the book?
There's been two books that have been written. There's been a dozen, but the two main books, one was written by Bob Crane's son, who is Crane.
I'm talking about the book you referenced earlier on the other case, where you said it was like someone's child or something.
George Hodel. It was Steve Hodel.
Okay. And you said there may have been an ulterior motive, besides doing that, it's a way to get money. So Bob Crane's son comes out with a book. So here's the great part, Barry. Apparently in his book, he says, well, if it's not John Carpenter, I know who killed my father. Yeah. Barry, do you know who he pinned it on?
Pinned it on Patty, his wife, Patricia Olson. Who? Yeah.
No, not her. He pinned it on Sigrid Valdis, who played Fräulein.
It's the same person.
Yeah, okay.
It's the same person. And what she did was, her real name was Patricia Olson, but she took on this name Sigrid for the show. She was on Hogan's Heroes with him,
yes,
right?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he points to her and says, she was a miserable human being who hated my father. I think she did it. He's pinning the murders on Fräulein Helga. For you Hogan's
Heroes
fans.
Because she was the only one that got any money from the murder.
That's
true. And that's why he did it.
But yeah. That also coincided with the release of his book. I'm sure that's a big coincidence.
Exactly. Coincidentally.
Yes,
coincides with the release of the book.
Now, Barry, we are going to an even more twisted murder involving sex. Well, I shouldn't say murder. It's at this point considered a suicide by the good folks and the authorities in the police department in Bangkok, Thailand. Bangkok, Thailand was the last spot that David Carradine was alive because on June 3rd, 2009, David Carradine was found dead in his apartment where he was in Bangkok filming a movie. There was many questions as to whether or not it was suicide or whether it was a murder. There were allegations that he was there for being a part of the sex trade industry. He was known to have really in Hollywood. It's one of these. I have to tell you, I always tell my wife, you know, just when you think you've heard everything, Barry, somebody goes and raises the bar a little bit, the freak bar, I call it. So this guy was into autoerotic asphyxiation, where he would restrain himself not only by the hands, but by the, dare I say, the genitalia, Barry, and then begin to choke himself out as a way of, quite frankly, getting himself off. It was pretty twisted stuff, Barry. David Carradine, Kane, who walked the earth in Kung Fu, was doing some pretty freaky stuff as he walked the earth.
Yeah, so he'll be Kane to a lot of people, but he's always going to be Bill to me. And he was a guy that he was in a great movie in the 1970s, directed by Paul Bartel, called Death Race 2000. I want to say that there was a remake with I forget what's that guy's name, the bald guy who's in all the action movies, Jason Statham.
Yes, Jason Statham.
Yeah, so there was a remake with that, but David Carradine had been, you know, he'd been making these B movies for years, and Kill Bill was kind of bringing him back into the spotlight a little bit. So I was kind of bummed when I found out about this. But so as you mentioned, he was making a movie. It was called Stretch. He was in Bangkok. Allegedly, he was a sexual deviant. And allegedly is basically by his ex-wives. You know, there's two or three ex-wives that have come out, Gail Jensen, Marina Anderson, and they stated publicly his sexual interests included the practice of self-bondage. There was a real dark side to him, a real intense side, and he had no qualms in exhibiting this behavior. The one thing that they did say about it, though, is that, and I got to say, so his former wife, Marina Anderson, guess what she did? She wrote a book, Jeff, that she coined profit from.
Go figure.
Yeah, so she wrote a book after the death, and it's called David Carradine, The Eye of My Tornado, that the actor never flew solo, and the autopsy and other details of his death just don't fit. So what she's basically saying is that he was murdered, in some research that I've done, generally, you know, look, you want to sell a book, you're going to create some controversy. I get that. However, something you just said at the very beginning of this is not something that's out there, but if you look for it, you'll find it. So Carradine was a sexual deviant. He liked any and everything. He it was very extreme to him. That's where he was. So supposedly, from one of these theories, he was in Thailand. He was doing a lot of illegal activities, I guess that would be considered in America, very deviant activities, and he was murdered by a pimp, and a pimp just being maybe the boyfriend of one of the girls that he was with or something like that, that he was doing this autoerotic asphyxiation, but at the same time, this pimp came in and basically killed him. So it's a really interesting story. It did bum me out because I was a fan of David Carradine, you know, whatever he was into sexually, more power to him, but kind of a sad end in the fact that, you know, here was a guy that, you know, he was known for a lot of drug usage in the 70s, and he was constantly being arrested for either drug or alcohol-induced behavior, and he winds up basically strangled to death in a fucking closet in Bangkok, Thailand. You know, what a way to go. So, yeah. Well, so was he murdered, or... You know, wasn't he not married? I don't know.
Here's what's crazy, Barry. As I was doing some research on this, do you know that David Carradine, amongst other things in his troubled life, tried to commit suicide at age 5? How does that enter the brain of a 5-year-old to kill themselves? And the reason, according to what I've read, is that he was very distraught and upset about the fact that his parents were constantly arguing. So whatever was going on in the arguments – it led David Carradine at age 5. I mean, I don't mean to make light of it. It's crazy to think of a 5-year-old wanting to kill themselves. And apparently his effort was obviously stopped, and his parents divorced a couple years later. His father, of course, John Carradine, a legendary film star from the 30s, 40s, and into the 50s, mainly in horror movies. I think he was Dracula in a couple of different films. He's got a very well-known Hollywood family, his brother Robert from the Revenge of the Nerds, Keith was very famous in the Oscar-winning Nashville. But this guy, man, you do a deep dive on his life. There was some troubling aspects about his life. So as I'm also researching it, there's an interview that Howard Stern did with Quentin Tarantino. And as Barry mentioned, David Carradine, to a much younger generation, is no longer known to them as Kane from Kung Fu. He's known as Bill from the Kill Bill movies. And so Stern is asking Tarantino, well, what do you think? What do you think happened? And Tarantino's response was, you know what? If that's what the guy was into doing, hell, he went out with a bang, like literally and figuratively. He was doing what he wanted to do. And Tarantino had a certain amount of, admiration for the fact that this guy went out doing what he wanted to do.
Yeah, unless he was murdered.
That's true. That would change things slightly.
That does change things a little slightly. And when you really start to look at this one too, and everybody says exactly the same thing. When you get his two wives, even the one who wasn't selling the book, she said that, part of the reason they got divorced was his abhorrent sexual deviance. So he was into some pretty freaky shit, but they both kind of maintained that he wasn't into this by himself. He wanted somebody else there with him. So, maybe he had a prostitute. Maybe he had an underage prostitute in Thailand with him. He kills himself by accident. Wasn't intentional. She freaks out and she leaves. I've always felt like there's more to this story. It's a footnote to David Carradine, because when you go back and apparently there's this allegation, if you research this as well, there's this allegation of incest that there was, and they're very, very vague about it, but that he was in some sort of incestuous relationship, with a relative, obviously. So there's a lot here. There's just so much to it. And had he died of a heart attack, it wouldn't have made, this would have been like he died of a heart attack. For David Carradine, this was kind of the way to go out, because he led such a bizarre, unusual life. And he was a really good actor. If you go back and you watch Kill Bill, he's really good. He really delivers his lines clearly and with a certain intensity. And he always had that kind of, like that, it's almost a stare. Like he's, I don't want to say it was an evil stare, but like he sees right through you when he looks at you. And I always pick that up from the screen. So I really like the guy. To me, it's a shame. It's a shame what happened. But look, if, as Quentin Tarantino said, if for any reason he did go out, doing what he really enjoyed, more power to him, I guess. Who am I to judge, Jeff?
Of course not you. Finally, our final murder or sex scandal we're going to, and this involves a little bit of both too, is probably, Barry, we've talked about Bob Crane. We've talked about Elizabeth Shore. We talked about all these famous Hollywood cases. Barry, perhaps the most famous murder in Hollywood history occurred on the 29th of November in 1981 off of Catalina, California. And that's the death of Natalie Wood. Natalie Wood, for those of you who don't know, was a very famous Hollywood actress as a youngster. She was in Miracle on 34th Street. Later, she was involved with West Side Story. Very famous young actress who then transitioned as an adult into more adult roles. And she was married to Robert Wagner, who was, of course, also a famous Hollywood star who had been in movies, who also he transitioned to television. He was in the show It Takes a Thief. He was in the show Heart to Heart. And so they were pretty much a Hollywood power couple. Let's be honest. They were, dare I say, the Brad and Angelina of their day, perhaps up to that level. So they're out on their yacht with Christopher Walken. Christopher Walken was making a movie with Natalie Wood called Brainstorm. And so they were spending a weekend on a boat. There were allegations that perhaps Natalie Wood was a bit enamored with her co-star, Mr. Walken, much to the chagrin of Robert Wagner. So what happens is, and by the way, a couple things that need to be discussed here. Natalie Wood apparently had an incident as a child where her mom, obviously a really good stage mom, had told her, the scene you're about to shoot where you go into a river, perfectly safe, there's nothing to worry about, and a young Natalie Wood almost drowns, and thereby she spends the rest of her life, literally and figuratively, afraid of going into the water. Okay, and apparently, this is merely an allegation, apparently she went to a fortune teller who told her at a very young age, you are one day going to die drowning. So this perpetuated this story with Natalie Wood that she's one day going to, you know, die. So she's completely terrified of the water. Now, that being said, while you're out on a yacht in the middle of the water, that's another question for another time. So anyway, we've got this love triangle going on here. We've got a yacht captain who's out there, and the shit hits the fan, as they say, Barry.
Yeah, so you're 100% right with that, too. And it's this is probably the most – you're right about that, too. But you did say something at the very beginning, though. You said the most famous murder. And quite frankly, I don't know if we can call it a murder.
It's okay, let's say the most famous death. How about that?
Yeah, it probably was, too. And Natalie Wood, if you look at Natalie Wood in her 20s, I think she was 42 or 43 when she died. But if you look at her when she was younger, and certainly still beautiful in her 40s, but she was, like, stunning. I mean, she absolutely was stunning. So this is, you know, this is one of those. She was enamored with Christopher Walken. She had been married and divorced from Robert Wagner and then remarried. And partly what happened, I think, with this was they found her body, I guess, a mile away. The body was floating in the water. But when they interviewed people, and I guess this was years later, like 100 people or something came forward, like this mass group of people, and they all basically said that they had heard them screaming loudly that night. And I guess Catalina Island, I'm not that familiar with it, but it's a very ritzy island off of Southern California, and people keep their boats and their yachts, I guess, and they're all near each other. So people had heard them arguing that night. There was a lot of I heard there was glass breaking. There was a lot going on, the rumor, you know, I guess for years was that Natalie Wood was having an affair with Christopher Walken, and Robert Wagner found out. So did he kill her? Did she fall in the water? Supposedly, according to everybody that knew her, she had a fear of water. She had a fear of dark water, and she was not either a good swimmer or knew how to swim at all. So for her to get into the dinghy just doesn't make a lot of sense. I will say that, you know, 37 years after this happened, the LA County Sheriff's Department reopened the investigation into her death. And 88-year-old Robert Wagner, can you believe he's 88? Heart
wow,
to heart that, is 88
crazy.
Years old. He's almost 90. He's called a person of interest. However, until he's charged, I guess, he's not talking. He's not saying a word. He refuses to talk about this case.
What's
your own personal opinion?
What's interesting about that is apparently Robert Wagner came out with a book, an autobiography, where he actually discussed this. And he went into dare I say, pretty specific details about what might have happened. It harkened back to the TV special OJ, how I would have done it if I, you know, had perchance to do it. And so Robert Wagner claims that he and Christopher Walken were having a, quote, political discussion. And that's all that they were talking about, that Natalie Wood had a little bit too much a drink. And had wandered away from the conversation. I believe Robert Wagner's version is that she apparently was trying to get in the dinghy that was attached to their boat. It was a pretty good sized boat. And trying to get into the dinghy, she slipped and fell into the water. They didn't know she was in the water. There were allegations by another boat that was nearby that there was a woman crying out for help, and that there was a male response was, okay, honey, we hear you. We're coming to get you. That's neither been confirmed, but that's one of the allegations. Natalie Wood had a 0.14 blood alcohol level, so she was pretty much trashed. So that doesn't help her if she falls into the water and can't swim. Her sister, Lana Wood, famous for her role in Diamonds Are Forever as Plenty O'Toole, was actually her name, though it's a great James Bond movie. Just a little side venture in amongst the murder or death talk here. Great line from Sean Connery is, you know, when she comes up to him and says, "Hi, I'm Plenty O'Toole." And he said, "Named after your father, I'm sure." But anyway, getting back to Lana Wood here, Lana Wood said there is no way that her sister, because of her fear of water, would have ever gotten near the water or in the dinghy by herself. That's why Lana Wood completely does not believe any of the versions of the story that involve, Natalie Wood wanting to get into the water. The boat captain, as alleged, and this might be one of the things that have reopened the case or renewed the cases, all these years later, he's alleged to have heard Robert Wagner say to Christopher Walken, and I quote, "Jesus Christ, what are you trying to do? Fuck my wife?" Now that's the boat captain saying that. Said, and so certainly, if it was the middle of a some sort of love triangle where you had alcohol involved, heated emotions, and a woman who couldn't swim, who may have, you know, for all we know, Natalie Wood just fell off the boat and couldn't recover. I don't know. Or did something nefarious happen with her scorned husband, who was looking, you know, looking at it like, I might be the joke of Hollywood for having my wife leave me for her young co-star. You know, it's one of those things. Here we are, Barry. How many years? Good Lord. It's 37 years later. And this case is still open. It's crazy. But yeah, that's another rabbit hole. If you want to go down on YouTube, look up the Natalie Wood murder. So, okay, Barry, believe it or not, woohoo! It looks like we're going to get in under 2 hours tonight. So I know that Brian Last will be extremely happy when he hears that. So a couple things I want to talk about. Barry, we didn't get a chance because we ran over. We recently lost a real legend in the wrestling business, Big Van Vader. And we wanted to send out our condolences to his family. And Barry, just some quick memories of Big Van Vader.
Yeah, so for me, Vader was, I didn't like his stuff in the States nearly as much as what I liked what he was doing when he was in Japan. The guy was a beast. I mean, you know, you go back and you hear that originally they wanted to tap the Ultimate Warrior for the Vader gimmick, and you go, what? How could that have ever worked? Because Vader was Vader. You know, even his baby bull Leon White in the AWA, the guy was, he had it, you know. So, look, there's a lot of stories out there, you know. I don't want to say anything negative, as a gentleman has just passed away, but there was a lot of stories about he was a legitimate tough guy, you know. But yeah, if Vader was, I don't think Vader ever truly hit his peak in the U.S., if anything. And I know he was WCW champion and certainly dominant there. And the WWF, he never really got what he, you know, it just, he was never pushed the way that he should have been pushed. And I remember the debut, one of his first or second weeks, he like came out and he like destroyed Gorilla Monsoon and somebody else, I forget. And I was like, they're going to do something with this guy. And it just never really happened. Should have been a bigger star, I think, in the U.S. But his Japan stuff, when you go back, it's timeless. It's, you could watch, you know, Vader versus Stan Hansen. And it's just, you know, you talk about, you would, to be in that ring, Jeff, it would take $1 million. It would take $10 million, because these guys beat the shit out of each other. And there's that one match that's famous where Hansen, I guess, gouges out Vader's eye, whether it's intentional or not intentional. I'll leave that up to you, but you've seen that, right?
Oh yeah. Vader was a guy that was given, a primo gimmick. He was the biggest gimmick of all time in New Japan Wrestling. He was put in with their biggest star, and he essentially annihilated the guy in three. Here's what I would draw a comparison to. Imagine if in, let's say WCW, in maybe the prime years of the NWO in 95, 96, 97, around that era, if WCW had brought in a monster heel who went out, and this was before Hogan had turned, whatever that timeline is, if they had had a guy come out and grab Hulk Hogan, toss him around the ring like a rag doll, and beat him in 3 minutes clean in the middle, imagine how over that guy would have been at that point. Having destroyed the lead babyface, you know, and that's what happened. And the fans in New Japan in the Sumo Hall in Tokyo rioted because it was such an unbelievable result. They were so unhappy about it. And it basically got the group banned from the Sumo Hall for over a year. So Van Vader got himself over real quick. He was, of course, put in that position. I will tell you the only caveat, first of all, for his size, he was an amazing athlete. A guy that was 400 pounds that could do a moonsault, for God's sakes, Barry. The only caveat I will say about Van Vader and Leon White in particular is I saw a shoot interview that he did many years ago. I don't know if it was with RF Video or one of the other groups. And they were talking to him about his legacy, and obviously Leon White held titles in so many different promotions, Mexico, Europe, Japan, WCW. And when he talked about his career, he was like, well, you know, I held all these world titles, you know, and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, it's a fucking work. You held the world titles because they gave them to you. It's not like you went in the UFC ring and you held them in four different weight classes because you're some kind of athletic freak. You were an athletic freak, but you were given the title because that's what the booker wanted to do. That was the only caveat I have with Leon White. He was really a tremendous worker, tremendous athlete for his size, a guy that had played college football at Division I, the highest level, got drafted by the LA Rams, but blew his knees out. So we offer up one for the memory of Leon White, Big Van Vader. Okay, a couple things we're wrapping up here, Barry. You referenced it very briefly. Folks, check out on Netflix, The Staircase. You want to talk about a riveting, riveting murder mystery of how a woman, the wife of a wealthy novelist in North Carolina, this is going back to 2001, but the story continues on up until modern, till literally about a year ago, goes over the course of about 15 years, how the wife of a wealthy novelist ended up dead at the bottom of a staircase. And here's that term that we use on Breaking Kayfabe. You go down the rabbit hole, folks. And there are so many tentacles and different variations of this story. And as a matter of fact, I was telling Barry about it before we started recording. He was like, shit, you're spoiling it for me, because I'm telling about stuff that happened in episode 5 and 6. And he didn't want to know. But a great, Barry, I agree. You texted me last night and you said, fuck, you got me again. I'm going to be up watching this one. It's a really great, compelling TV show. Folks, thank you for joining us here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Breaking Kayfabe is, in fact, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. As we're leaving, I just want a couple quick shout-outs. I would ask you, if you are so inclined, to leave us a positive review on the iTunes network. We always love those positive reviews as they help us work the algorithm. I've heard that used in another podcast before. I want to give a shout-out to John Boucher. John Boucher bought a Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry t-shirt. And I want to encourage all you folks to join us on our Facebook group at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. If you have, invite your friends over. We'll take a look at them. If they seem like they're a fairly decent people, not sketchy, we'll invite them in. Until next week, folks, for my friend, Mr. Barry Rose, this is Bowdrin the Booker. They call me the Booker. We'll see you next week. And thanks to the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network and our friend Brian Last.